coming up on Philosophy Talk.
If babies are so smart, why are we so stupid?
Can studying the minds of babies help unravel age-old philosophical conundrums about consciousness, truth, and morality?
Looking at what babies do, at what they look at what they reach for, you can learn the incredible range of things that human beings can learn.
Babies as little scientists.
When babies are just playing, just exploring things, they're actually doing experiments. They're actually putting nature to the test.
Our guest is Alison Gopnik, author of The Philosophical Baby.
Babies aren't living in a blooming buzz and confusion. Literally, from the moment they're born, they already are relating themselves to other people.
Recorded in front of a live audience at the Marsh Theater in San Francisco.
Give them an environment that's rich, full of, you know, mud and livestock and relatives, and they'll find out what's going on.
From the minds of babies.
Coming up on Philosophy Talk, after the news. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Today we're recording the program in front of a live audience at the Marsh Theater, San Francisco's breeding ground for new performance.
Our thinking originated at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus.
Welcome to Philosophy Talk. Our topic today, from the minds of babies.
Can't imagine what it's like to be a newborn baby. For months, you've been all alone in this warm and cozy womb, your every need catered to. Then suddenly, out of the blue, you're thrust into a chaotic world filled with strange new sights and sounds and people, lots of people, big people. And they're doing all sorts of things you have no idea about, like whacking you on the bottom. All you can do is lie there, looking helpless, cute, and dumb.
Well, John, fortunately, babies may look dumb, but they're actually a lot smarter than they look. I mean, they get their bearings in the world very quickly. And before you know it, these helpless creatures are speaking a language, having deep insights about the causal structure of the physical world and the moral structure of the social world. It's amazing.
Well, that raises the question. Just how do babies manage to get from where they start to having all of these abilities, to learning so much so quickly and effortlessly?
Well, there are at least two possible answers to that question, John, at least two. One is that babies are so good at figuring things out because we're so good at teaching them things.
That was basically the empiricist view in philosophy and the behaviorist view in psychology. This view supposes that a baby's mind starts as a tabula rasa, a blank slate, nothing written on it. This view grants that babies have an inborn capacity to learn from experience, but insists that until they actually acquire some experience, they won't know anything.
So babies on this view really are born dumb, and our jobs as parents and teachers is to help arrange the kids' experience so that all the right things and none of the wrong things are written onto that blank slate. So we have a big responsibility in this.
Yeah, view. Yeah. It'd be nice to have a view that gave us less responsibility, and there is one. The second possibility is that although babies appear to be good at learning, they really don't need to learn much of anything because they come into the world already knowing a lot more than we would have thought. That's the nativist view. There's a very long tradition of nativist thinking in philosophy and a somewhat shorter but still robust tradition of it in psychology and especially linguistics.
So on this nativist view, babies are born smart. I mean, really smart. Think of how effortlessly a kid acquires her first language. She doesn't do it by sitting in boring language classes, reading confusing grammar books, or memorizing long vocabulary lists. We just talk to them. And before you know it, I mean, really, in the blink of an eye, they're talking back.
And they continue talking back at you for quite a while.
Yeah.
The speed and reliability with which kids acquire their first language has convinced a lot of people that children aren't blank slates at all. Kids just seem to come specially equipped for picking up language, as if they had the basic structure of language hardwired into their brains right from the start, with their only real problem to figure out which particular language is being spoken.
Right, right. You know, and this sort of nativist approach is pretty attractive. It has a lot going for it, I think. But it can also get pretty extreme, at least in some thinkers' hands. The philosopher Jerry Fodor, an arch-nativist if there ever was one, is famous for arguing that pretty much all concepts are innate. And in his view, the only thing the kid really has to learn is which specific words, like how do you say quark around here, the people around her use to express which of the concepts she already has.
So a baby already starts knowing a lot of physics and mathematics, and I guess by the time you get to someone like me, an enormous amount has been forgotten. But at any rate, the baby knows all this and just lacks the right words to express what it knows. It just seems incredibly implausible.
I agree with you. That seems really implausible. But you know what's equally implausible is the idea that kids are just blank slates. There's clearly a lot going on in babies' minds right from the start. Much more than empiricists and behaviorists have ever imagined, and maybe less than the nativist imagined. So we got to find another way.
Sadly, Ken, in order to figure out what's inside of the minds of babies, we're going to have to leave the realm of pure a priori philosophy.
Oh, shucks.
We're going to need the help of someone who doesn't just think about babies and their brains, but actually digs around, metaphorically speaking, in the hidden reaches of the infant mind.
That would be the renowned developmental psychologist Alison Gottman, author of the best-selling The Philosophical Baby, What Children's Minds Tell Us About Truth, Love, and the Meaning of Life. She'll be joining us in just a little bit.
And we plan to get lots of insights from our live audience here at the Marsh as well.
But first, our roving philosophical reporter, April Dembowski, talks to someone who pokes around the minds of babies while they poke around in the playground. She files this report.
The sandbox is a critical place of learning for young children. These kids are on the playground of the Harold E. Jones Child Study Center at UC Berkeley. They're playing a game called Volcano. They buried a garden hose underneath a big mound of sand, and water, or hot lava, is spouting out the top, and the kids are trying to stop it.
It's exploding, quick!
Jane Perry is a researcher and preschool teacher overseeing the game. She explains that what's happening for these small firefighters is more than just child's play.
It does incite all kinds of problem solving. They're operating really at the peak of their thinking right now.
These kids are 3 and 4 years old. Until now, they've had their parents at their side for life's basics, eating, sleeping, potty training. But this game introduces them to a sense of independence. Now the focus is on interacting with their peers.
This is, unusual to have. How many kids do we have? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 kids collaborating together.
The whole point is to keep the game going, to keep having fun. To do that, the kids need buy-in from each other, much like adults need when they want to produce a concert or start a company. These collaboration skills are honed on the playground. Perry observes how one girl gets the others to go along with her.
She's delicately suggesting that her idea might be more effective. These are the subtle negotiating strategies that kids use.
Sometimes the play is all about the negotiation itself. Often, by the time kids agree who will be the mommy and daddy in a game of house, everyone has moved on to the slide. Preschool teacher Christy Schumacher has observed many such negotiations.
We're eating hot dogs, right? Right. We like ketchup on them, right? No, but we like mustard, too. Oh, right, right. Yeah, we like mustard, too. And we don't like onions, right. Yeah, they really often really have to stretch, for their peers. As an adult, they can throw a fit or comply or whatever. But with their peers, it's like, ooh, they have to work it out or else game's over sometimes, yeah.
At this age, the majority of games that kids play are make-believe.
We're pretending to be Indians.
I'm playing cake.
Boat. Fire truck.
Rocket ship.
I'm playing with my mask.
Chocolate vanilla. It's a rainbow cake.
Research shows that pretend play teaches kids discipline and impulse control. In one study, kids were asked to stand still against a wall for as long as they could. Most couldn't last even a minute. But when kids were told to make believe they were guards at a factory, standing watch over the building, they stood at attention for 4 minutes.
Pretend couches the momentum and focuses it in a way that's really directive.
Educator Jane Perry says that giving kids a framework for an activity helps them exercise higher level skills. But government funding rewards schools where kids get good test scores, not where kids invent sophisticated imaginary friends.
Very didactic performance oriented learning activities are okay for targeted information, but are not good for more holistic skills.
Perry says the best thing parents can do for their young children is take them outside.
They can
have the opportunity to really use their whole body, which is what kids need to be doing. The more their whole body is involved with thinking, the more integrated their growth is.
For Philosophy Talk, I'm April Domboski.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk, coming to you from the Marsh Theater in San Francisco. I'm John Perry, and with me is Ken Taylor.
And we're joined now by Allison Gopnik. She's professor of psychology and affiliate professor of philosophy at UC Berkeley. She's author most recently of The Philosophical Baby, What Children's Minds Tell Us About Truth, Love, and the Meaning of Life. And this is on the New York Times bestseller list, folks. So go out and get this book. Allison, welcome back to Philosophy Talk.
Well, I always love being here.
Allison, you started out your academic career as a philosophy major. For reasons that are hard to understand, you left this academic Eden for the hurly-burly of psychology and developmental psychology in particular. What led you to that strange decision?
Yeah. Well, I'm the oldest of six children, so that means that from the time I was very young, in fact, I also had my own first babies in graduate school, I've been looking at babies and young children, and I always thought they were the most fascinating beings you could imagine. But I've also always had a passion for philosophy and for some of the big philosophical questions. How can we come to understand about the world? What does it mean to know what causes what? How do we understand other people? And it always seemed to me, as a philosopher, that we could get some answers to those questions by actually looking at young babies. And I went to Oxford to do my graduate work, partly because that was a place where I could be doing philosophy, and I could also be doing developmental psychology. So when I was in Oxford, I was spending half my time way up in the villas with the women and children. They park their women and children far away from the actual serious academic philosophers at Berkeley, and half my time down with the philosophers. And one day I realized I could spend the rest of my life either with a community of completely disinterested seekers after truth or with a community of sort of spoiled, egocentric, fragile egos who basically needed to be petted and taken care of by women all the time. And because the first group were the babies and the second group were the philosophers, I figured I'd better spend the rest of my life with the babies. But I like hanging out with you philosophers,
well,
too.
I'm really glad to hear it. Now, going back to another person who was both a philosopher and a psychologist, William James thought he knew what it was like to be a baby. He said, or at least a two-year-old, he said their minds were a big, blooming, buzzing confusion. So two questions to you. Was he right? And if so, or if not, how do either of you know?
Yeah, so that's a good question. Well, it turns out that James, although he was a great psychologist, was really wrong. Babies aren't living in a blooming, buzzing confusion. Literally, from the moment they're born, they already understand a lot about the people, the language, the objects that are going on around them. And part of the reason why James, even though he was so smart, could get this so wrong, he and all the other philosophers and psychologists before him, was because if you just look cursorily at a baby, just sort of look superficially at them, they look pretty stupid and pretty confused. P.G. Woodhouse said that babies look like badly poached eggs, which is, you know, sort of a little unfair, but it's true. You just look at a baby and it doesn't look like much is going on. So what we had to learn was how to ask babies what they were thinking in their language instead of ours.
You mean goo goo gaga? You mean like...
Well, not goo goo gaga, but looking at what babies do, at what they look at what they reach for. That turned out to be a much better way of finding out what was going on in their minds than trying to get them to talk.
Right, so the basic method of your discipline, I mean, we can kind of study what babies are focusing on and how long they'll focus on it, what they'll pay attention to, when they'll stop paying attention, and that helps tell us a lot, I take it. Is that right?
Well, we've had to be very clever over the last 30 years in figuring out ways that we could look at, say, what a baby reaches for, what a baby looks at. And even with 3 and 4 year olds, when you just listen to what they say, you ask them what they're thinking, and you get a beautiful stream of conscious monologue about volcanoes and cowboys and all sorts of things. So we've had to look at what they do rather than what they say.
So back in the day, when psychologists studied pigeons and then gravitated to rats, you could put a rat in a Skinner box and be all wired up and get all kinds of measurements and data. You can't do that with a baby. So videotape and that kind of stuff must help a lot.
Yeah, so videotape was our great instrument. That was our great imaging instrument, because that way we could look at what babies' faces were like, what their emotional expressions were like, and we could see objectively, scientifically, that what they were doing actually really made a lot of sense.
So there's been a kind of scientific revolution in the study of babies that helps us know a lot more than the ancient philosophical and even psychological guesses about what was going on. Well, I mean, it's real science.
Right. I think people who knew babies best, the caregivers, always thought that there was more going on than was there on the surface. But to do science, we need to just have more than just intuitions. We have to actually find out what the truth is. And that's what we've been doing in finding out about
this
babies.
This is a special edition of Philosophy Talk, coming to you from the Mars Theater in San Francisco. We're discussing the minds of babies with Alison Gopnik, author of The Philosophical Baby.
In our next segment, we'll ask what, if anything, philosophers can learn from infants. Do the minds of babies really hold the secret to enduring philosophical puzzles like consciousness, causation, morality, the very nature of truth?
The wisdom of the ages through the minds of babies, plus questions from our live audience when Philosophy Talk continues.
Welcome back to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about the minds of babies. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from the Mars Theater, San Francisco's breeding ground for new performance.
Do babies come into the world already equipped to learn language and culture? Or are their minds really just blank slates? What wisdom can the minds of babies shed on age-old philosophical conundrums about consciousness, truth, and morality?
We'd love to know your thoughts. So step up to one of the microphones on either side of the theater here and give us your questions.
Our guest is Alison Gopnik, author of The Philosophical Baby, What Children's Minds Tell Us About Truth, Love, and the Meaning of Life.
So Alison, you advertise in your book, you know, the baby's minds are key to helping us understand some long-standing philosophical puzzles and quandaries about mind and self and all that. Give me your favorite example from your book of what studying babies helps us understand.
Well, let's take some of the questions that you guys were talking about at the beginning, some of these questions about empiricism and nativism. One of the deepest questions in philosophy has always been, how can we find out the truth about the world? After all that comes to us from the world are photons hitting the back of our retina and little disturbances of air at our ears, and yet all of us live in a world of chairs and tables and people and quarks and photons and distant planets. How do we ever get, and we think that's true, how do we ever get there from here? Well, what we've started to discover, really, just even in the past 10 years, is that babies have extremely powerful learning mechanisms, very powerful capacities for things like probabilistic induction, the sort of things that philosophers of science have talked about, very sophisticated scientists doing. Now, babies do all this unconsciously, not consciously, but they can use some of the same kinds of techniques for looking at patterns of probability in the world and inferring the way the world works that we see in science and we see in very sophisticated machine learning. Let me give you a practical example. Maybe an impractical example. This is work that my colleague Fei Xu at Berkeley has done. So what she did was she showed babies a box full of ping pong balls. This is the classic philosophical urn. In philosophy, it's always an urn. So she showed them an urn full of ping pong balls, 80% white, 20% red. And then, this was with nine-month-old babies, she showed them an experimenter who either took four white and one red ball out of the box, or took four red and one white ball out of the box. Now, if the baby's thinking like a philosopher, then she should think that that second sequence, four red and one white, although it's possible, is very improbable given the nature, the statistical nature of the urn. And sure enough, that's exactly what nine-month-olds thought. Nine-month-olds looked much longer at the possible but improbable event than at the more likely one.
Right.
So these tiny babies already implicitly were using principles about randomness, about selection, the kinds of things that we would use if we were very sophisticated.
You have another
scientists.
Book called The Scientist in the Crib, in which you talk about how babies are little scientists. And I mean, I think this is a deeply important point, because go back to what we said about language and how rapidly and effortlessly kids seem to acquire language. That convinced people like Chomsky that it was already all in there, and there wasn't really much of a learning problem, because if it were a learning problem, given the meager data they had to work on, it would be impossible.
Exactly.
He thought statistical regularities couldn't possibly do it. But this new kind of work you're talking about, I think it's really eye-opening. It's deeply eye-opening, because it gives you, you don't have to be a full-bore Chomsky nativist, and you don't have to be a naive empiricist. The baby's minds are really complicated learning machines.
Exactly. So I think we're getting to a place which isn't just a sort of, you know, wishy-washy compromise between nativism and empiricism. What we're actually starting to say is, here's what babies start out knowing, here's the learning mechanisms that they're born with, and the amazing thing is that you put those two things together and you can learn the incredible range of things that human beings can learn.
So let's go to a somewhat different realm, morality. Mm-hmm. My favorite philosopher, David Hume, says there's an inborn benevolence in human beings. It's not terribly strong. It can be easily destroyed, but in the right thing, it can be nurtured. Do you find that there's an inborn benevolence in babies and toddlers?
Well, not only do we find that that's true, but actually, Hume, who is also my favorite philosopher, I think got it right in an even deeper sense. Because what Hume said, and he was sort of alone among moral philosophers in saying this, was that the origin of that benevolence came in our emotions, in our feelings, not just in what we think. And when we look at even very young babies, we see that even young babies are already empathic. They already can recognize and take on the feelings of others. And by the time they're 15 months old, they're not only empathic, but altruistic.
You've got some nice experiments about this that illustrate this.
That's right. So this is an experiment that actually was done by Felix Wernicke. And what he did was he took 14-month-olds, and they saw an experimenter either drop a pencil on the ground and then look as if he was reaching for it, or throw the pencil to the ground as if he wanted it on the ground. Now it was on the ground. The baby could get to it. The experimenter couldn't. And the babies had to actually crawl over a bunch of cushions to get to the pencil. Well, if the experimenter dropped the pencil and then looked like he wanted it, the babies would climb all the way across the room to pick up the pencil and give it to him. But if he threw it to the ground so it looked like he didn't want it, they wouldn't. So these very little babies already seem to be able to read, here's what he wants, here's his desire, and if that's what he wants, then I'll help him get it.
Wow. Hume was so bright.
Well, that's amazing. So does that suggest you, first of all, a reminder, audience, you're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about the minds of babies with renowned developmental psychologist Alison Gopnik, who's author of the best-selling book, The Philosophical Baby. We love to hear from our live audience. If you've got questions, go up to the mic on either side of the room, and we'll get to them. But so the nascent nativist in me thinks that what you just said shows that people really are born knowing something deep about the structure of one another's minds. And that's part of the human trick, that our minds are not opaque. You know, philosophers had this problem of other minds.
Right.
How can I be sure there's another mind out there? Because it just moves around and behaves, and it could be an automaton. But it seems like we're equipped to read one another's minds from the start. Is that right or wrong?
That seems to be absolutely true. Now, if you think about it, as we're looking around a room, what we're really seeing in the room is a bunch of bags of skin that are stuffed into pieces of cloth and have little dots at the top that move. But that's crazy, right? I mean, that's a creepy,
slightly unkind.
Yeah. Well, it turns out that even newborns don't ever see bags of skin. Even newborns already connect the way they feel inside and the way other people behave on the outside. But the interesting thing, and again, this makes the point about nativism and empiricism, is that although babies start out knowing some fundamental things about other people, basically they're like me, they also have to learn a lot. So it seems as if what happens is babies start out thinking, I'm like you and you're like me. The great discovery is, wait a minute, sometimes you're not like me. Sometimes you might want something different than I do, or believe something different than I do. And a lot of the tsuris that we have in adult politics comes because it's hard even for adults to understand.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about the minds of babies with Alison Gopnik at the MAR, San Francisco's breeding ground for new performance. And we've got questions from our live audience. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, sir.
Yes, thank you. My name is Alan Wagner. And it's been a while since I considered psychology. Back in my undergraduate years, a few decades ago. So I'm not up to speed on it, but I do have a question about Gordon Allport, who was at Harvard at the time, wrote a book about a sense of proprium, when a child distinguishes itself from its environment, giving rise to the sense of subject-object separation. Prior to that, there's this undifferentiated sense, is what he was speculating. A child could bite its foot and not even know it's biting its foot. So now I'm wondering that at that point in time, what you're looking at comes in from this culture of subject-object differentiation. And I'm speculating, well, what is it that precedes that? Aren't you kind of looking in and expecting to find things there? How do you take yourself out of the picture of what's going on with the child? Maybe the natural phenomenon is that you put it there, and then the child gives rise to the sense of subject-object, and then that being is a being.
Right.
That's a complicated question.
Good, complicated question.
Yeah.
So let me give you a short answer that I hope will illustrate the answer to this as well. We think that from the time babies are very little, they are differentiating between themselves and others, but their sense of self is very different from ours. And I guess the answer to the question, how do we know we're not just reading ourselves into the babies, is they keep surprising us. They keep coming up with things that we never would have thought of. So this is a really good example. I have a whole chapter in the book about children's sense of self. And it turns out that although children differentiate themselves and others from very early, it's only when they're 3 or 4 years old that they start to have a self that's extended through time the way we do. So we take it for granted as adults that there's this little thing, me, that self sitting inside of my head. And it's the same one that was there 5 years ago, and it's the same one that'll be there 5 years ago. It's my little inner chief executive officer and autobiographer. Jerry Fodor, who Ken mentioned, once said, well, someone has to be in charge, so it better be me. And that's the reason why we have a sense of self. But philosophers, including our favorite philosopher Hume, have pointed out that that doesn't really make a lot of sense. I mean, how do we know that that we look inside? There isn't a little person inside of us who's ourself. And in fact, children seem to have to invent and discover that idea of the self inside of them that's the same in the past and the future.
So looking at religion and philosophy, there's always been this idea that for God when he was alone, or for the child before it knows anything, oddly enough, there's this kind of similar problem of how do they fit in. And one point of view, which you find in the Upanishads, I'll just say to show off, and also in Descartes, right, is that there is this I, but you're alone, solipsism. Right. But then a critic of that, Lichtenberg, critic of Descartes, said, no, you shouldn't say, I think, as Descartes did in the second meditation. You should say, oh, there's some thought.
Right.
That the one who notices the thought really isn't present at all. So it's kind of the selfless origin versus the solipsistic origin. Does either of those resonate with what you think is going on in the baby's mind, or are they both kind of misguided?
No, I think something like the second picture is much more like what we see with children. So as I say, from the moment they're born, they're not solipsists. They already are relating themselves to other people. Mm-hmm. It's not that they're undifferentiated, but they recognize right away there's other people in the world like me. And really, the creation is the creation of the idea that I have a self, and that self is the same and extends across different situations and times. So I think that's another example of how actually looking at children can help answer a long-standing philosophical question. Where does our self come from?
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about the minds of babies with Alison Gopnik in front of a live audience at the Mars Theater. And we got a question from that live audience now. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, sir.
Hi, my name is Neil, and I'm from Boston. I wanted to ask a question relating to the Roving Philosophical Report. I got convinced that there is a connection between playing and learning, between exercising the imagination and being able to learn stuff about the world. And I just wasn't able to understand why that link is so essential. Why is it the case that you can't just separate learning the facts about the world from playing around in the world?
You got to read Allison's book, but take it away, Allison.
Yeah, so that's a great question.
That's a great setup.
One of the big philosophical puzzles has been, what is it that fiction and imagination do for us? You know, Plato actually said he was going to exile all the poets from the Republic because, first of all, they were liars, and secondly, they weren't even good liars, right? They lied and they
somehow didn't even persuade you that what they were saying was true. What role does imagination play? And that's particularly vivid with young children because it involves the capacity to think about possibilities. And one of the things that we've been discovering from the new work in cognitive science is that when we understand about the world, it isn't just that we learn the truth about the world, that problem we talked about before. The reason we really want to understand the world is so we can know all the possibilities, right, all the other ways the world could be. And for human beings who create our own environment, in some ways, knowing the possible is even more important than knowing the actual. If you look in this room that we're in right now, everything in this room is imaginary from the perspective of a hunter-gatherer. The seats, the people, the lights, all those all started out in the imagination of some human being.
This is why you and John should not be such a big fan of Hume. Because you get the association of ideas, you see these ideas constantly conjoined, and you kind of project them into the future with no warrant. And like the fancies of the imagination, in which you freely combine and recombine things, never give you access to any deep reality. But I think you're right. I think the answer to this question is a deep and profound one. Imagining is walking through a realm of possibilities. And for kids, you make the point, for kids, that's a really, really, really important thing to do. Right, so there's a reason, a sort of evolutionary reason,
exactly,
why kids are seized with the imagination.
Well, but Hume, you know, he pointed out. He said, you know, you shouldn't be worried about induction, and the fact that we can't give a rational justification of it. It's much too important to be supported by such a thin reed as reason. Our induction comes from the same source as animals, and he might have well have said evolution. Right.
Right.
So. Two cheers for Hume.
And again, to defend Darling David, one of the other things that Hume thought was that we use that association to find out the causal structure of the
right.
world. And at least one interpretation of Hume is that he didn't just think we had associations, we used them. Those were the basis for understanding causes. And when we know that one thing causes another, we not only understand reality, yeah. but possibility.
That's certainly true. But if you want to understand the deep sources of our ability to think about counterfactual possibilities, possibilities that don't obtain, right, I don't think Hume's going to illuminate you very much. But I'll just, you're listening to
philosophy. But three-year-olds will. Yes. So hang out with the three-year-olds.
There you go. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're thinking about what's on the minds of babies with Alison Gopnik, author of The Philosophical Baby.
In our final segment, we'll ask whether it's possible for adults to recover any of the lost wisdom of early childhood.
We're coming to you from the Marsh, San Francisco's breeding ground for new performance. We'll answer more questions from our live audience when Philosophy Talk continues.
Welcome back to the program. I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. Our topic, The Minds of Babies. Our guest, Alison Gopnik, author of the best-selling The Philosophical Baby, What Children's Minds Tell Us About Truth, Love, and the Meaning of Life. And we've got lots of questions from our live audience. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, ma'am.
Thank you. I'm Andrea from San Francisco.
Okay.
So you're talking about babies having this incredible ability to learn and absorb, and I really like the language as an example. It's very hard for me to sit down and learn a new language in a couple of months. So maybe you don't know the answer to this question, but what happens to us after we're babies?
Right.
Why do we lose this ability
to
learn so well?
Excellent question.
Yeah, this is the, if babies are so smart, why are we so stupid question. And in fact, one of the interesting things about babies is that we have childhood and babyhood at all. An interesting evolutionary question. Why are we so helpless, so immature, so useless for such a long period of time?
Does any other animal creature have anything like our childhood as a proportion of their life compared to us?
No, that we're way off on the end of the distribution in how immature we are for how long. And of course, at Berkeley, we're even further.
Yeah.
But the moral of that is a good moral, which is that it also turns out that the longer the period of immaturity of a species, the smarter, the more flexible, the more that species depends on learning as an adult. So what seems to happen is that nature has, evolution has a kind of designed a kind of division of labor where we have an early protected period where we can learn all the things we need to, we can envision all these great possibilities we were talking about. And then as adults, we take all those things that we learned when we were babies and we put them to use to actually go out and plan and function and do the things that we need to do.
I mean, one of the things you say in your book, which I really like, but in some ways it's kind of startling. I don't think you quite put it this way, but babies and grown-ups are, in a way, different kinds of animals.
Exactly.
Right? It's like we're two species in one, because as grown-ups, we got to stay on task, we got to stay focused, right? And all this wandering attention, the seizable attention that babies exhibit would be ruinous, because I know this myself, because I haven't got it for our adult lives, but being like an adult as a baby would be ruinous for your task of trying to figure out who you are, where you are. Right.
Exactly. So one of the things I say is that it's like the transition from caterpillars to butterflies, except they're the butterflies who get to flutter around and explore, and we're the caterpillars who have to hump along our little narrow adult path. So the answer to the question is the kind of intelligence that we need as adults to be able to, say, do long-term planning, imagine our future goals, save up for our lives, and very importantly, take care of those babies, have enough resources to keep those babies going. That kind of intelligence isn't the kind of intelligence that would be the best for learning as many new things as possible.
Well, if you think about it, we go around and each decision we make, we have to take account not just of what we're conscious and aware of, but this tremendous structure that we've got in our minds of, you know, IRAs and retirement and what's Obama going to do and what's my children going to do and what's the traffic light and what's the weather going to be. So we only have a little bit of room left to really pay attention to what's happening. And a point you make in the book is that's not true with babies. And so in a way, they're much more conscious than we are.
That's right. So I think what happens is that as adults, our very experience of the world is narrowed down to these things that are important to us, all that stuff that we have to do. And again, there's a kind of intrinsic trade-off between our ability to learn something new and how much we already know. Again, to be fair to grown-ups, part of the reason why we have so much trouble learning new things is because we already know so much.
Right.
And very rationally, as grown-ups, mostly we depend on what we already know.
That's my big problem in philosophy. I seem to know so much that I have hard relating to
on that note of modesty, let's take another question from our live audience. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, sir.
Thank you. My name is Josh. I'm from San Francisco. And I'd like to ask you to get back to the nativism question, mm-hmm. if you would. You said that babies come equipped with capacities for learning and also with this intuitive sense of other minds. Mm-hmm. Are there other components that mm-hmm. that also come inbuilt?
Yeah. So we think that babies are born, for instance, knowing a lot about the physical structure of the world or having some ideas about the physical structure of the world. Things like how objects go behind one another, mm-hmm. how objects work, how they move. Those are all things that babies seem to be born, at least having first pass hypotheses about, just like they have first pass hypotheses about what other people are like. But they're also born with these abilities for probabilistic reasoning and for statistics and for experimenting. And that means that they can change those things that they start out thinking, again, very much like scientists. A scientist who didn't start out with a hypothesis wouldn't be able to get very far. But a scientist who just stuck with the hypotheses that he started out with wouldn't be able to get very far
either.
But,
you know, reading your stuff on this often makes me wonder. So the scientific revolution is a particular point in human history, a sui generis, I think somewhat precarious point in human history.
Right.
Took lots of social structure. But in some sense, if we already had that trick,
right
of experimenting, you say, I think rightly, that babies are not just Baconian observers, right? Bacon had this view that the way to advance knowledge is to just observe, to be a relentless observer, right? But That's not enough. You've got to be an experimenter. You've got to put a question to the world and make the world answer it. And Kant thought this was a great insight. But you sort of say that babies already have this insight.
That's right.
How did it take so long to become a cultural, externalized thing?
Well, the babies, this gets back to what we were saying before. We actually have some beautiful experiments now that show that when babies are just playing, just exploring things, they're actually doing experiments. They're actually putting nature to the test. And I think the answer about why it took us so long to do science has to do with this division of labor between the babies and adults that I mentioned before. So for most of history, we've depended on this kind of unconscious science that we do as
or at least implicit signs that we do as babies. And then that was enough to let us do the things that we need to do as adults. And animals didn't have very much spare time to be able to actually just learn and explore. When we finally got enough, you know, resources and food so that grown-ups could think about something else than just getting along every day, that was when I think we started using some of these infantile capacity.
So that leads to another question. That makes me kind of sad in a way, what you just said. Because we've talked a bit about what philosophers can learn about these longstanding philosophical puzzles from the minds of babies. What about we adults in general? Right? You just told us it took us centuries to catch up with, we needed more leisure to catch up with the experimental methods of children in our shared culture. But how can we adults, ordinary adults, learn to live happier, more fulfilled, more exciting lives from babies? Do you think there's any way?
Wear diapers. That really is.
Well, the sad truth is that, of course, part of the reason why babies can learn so much is exactly because they don't have to take care of even the most basic fundamental aspects of life. All that's getting taken care of for them by other people. And I'm a kind of capital R romantic. I'm very sympathetic to the babies and their wonderful expanded consciousness. But the truth is, you know, like when you occasionally meet adult guy capital R romantics, that depends a lot on having other people take care of you. Yeah. So I think one of the great things about actually being a caregiver for children, which is one of the most fundamental, deep, and philosophically neglected aspects of human nature, is the part of our nature which is about taking care of babies. One of the things that's really fantastic about that is it's simultaneously the most adult thing we ever do, the hardest, the one with greatest investment, the greatest devotion, the greatest concentration is demanded by taking care of babies. And yet, at the same time, when we hang out with babies, we get to vicariously experience this expanded world. So, you know, the 5 minutes it takes to go to the grocery store when you're walking with a two-year-old, you suddenly realize that two blocks is like Blake's world, universe
right.
in a world
oh,
of sand.
I really love getting down on the ground and playing with my kids and then with my grandkids. Now my youngest grandkid is 12, and, you know, I just am waiting for that next generation. I want to ask you a question. It's really kind of self-serving. Back in the day, maybe I guess half a century ago, Piaget was a big guy.
Right.
He was asking a lot of the questions and making similar claims about the importance of children's thinking to philosophy that you are. But without the experimental apparatus, without videotape, a lot of anecdotes, heavily criticized, not very fashionable within psychology today. How does your view differ from, and in what ways is it similar to,
sure.
Piaget's?
Right. So Piaget is the great founding father of developmental psychology and was really the first person in history, I think, to realize the philosophical depth of babies. But he was working 100 years ago. He was the first person to do it. And a lot of the empirical things that he said have turned out to be wrong. But I think his deep philosophical view, the view that looking at babies and young children could tell us about human nature, and that the answer would not be either simple nativism or empiricism, but that babies were actively going out and experimenting and finding out about the world and truth, I think that answer has turned out to be right. So we see ourselves, we new generation, see ourselves as Piaget's inheritors.
Let me ask you one last quick question. Okay, it strikes me that the emerging scientific understanding of what babies' minds are like, and by babies you mean not just newborns, but kids up to
right.
four or five, is that
yeah,
true?
Yeah.
Okay, should have applications for how we educate them.
Right.
Are we doing things rightly, wrongly?
Well, I think there's kind of two morals. One moral is that all of the stuff, the baby Einstein and the educational toys and the No Child Left Behind testing and all that, is the best you can say about it is it's useless. There's one moral, which is that, you know, mostly what we need to do is babies are already as smart as can be. Let them alone, give them toys, give them an environment that's rich, full of, you know, mud and livestock and relatives, and they'll find out what's going on. But the other moral is that in the past, we did have that mud and livestock and relatives sort of for free. We had caregivers around who were really devoted to babies, and we know that that's what babies need to learn. And at the moment, we don't support those caregivers very well. We don't provide things like parental leave or decent pay for preschool teachers. So on the one hand, we waste billions on things that won't make any difference. On the other hand, we don't provide the kind of social and economic and also, I think, philosophical underpinning for the idea that caregiving is an incredibly deep part of the human adventure and the human condition.
That's fascinating. I wish we could talk about that some more. But on that note, I'm going to thank you for joining us. It's been a wonderful conversation, as always.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
Our guest has been Allison Gopnik. She's a professor of psychology and also an affiliate professor of philosophy at the UC Berkeley. She's author of the very fine book, the best-selling book, The Philosophical Baby, What Children's Minds Tell Us About Truth, Love, and the Meaning of Life. And I've read most of this book, and I really do want to recommend it. It's not just full of great science. It's beautifully written. Allison is probably the best scientific writer I have. This is beautifully written book.
We also want to thank everyone in our live audience for participating in the program. Let's give you a round of applause.
So, John, you got any final thoughts?
Well, I think you had some insights about Hume as I think it over. Hume was a great philosopher, but he may have kind of shortchanged the importance of activity. And you certainly couldn't say that about Piaget, who really saw the baby as an inquiry. So maybe Hume plus Piaget plus videotape and a wonderful mind, and we get Allison Gopnik.
But you know who Piaget's thought was the deepest philosopher, as I understand it, was our buddy Kant. He thought he was seeing Kantian philosophy implemented in the minds of,
yeah,
of babies.
Kant is just kind of Hume through a distorting prism.
No, because the point is the active construal of the world, not the passive, rush of sensibility and sort of summing it up, but the active probing and constructing and construal of the world. And it seems clear from all this great research that Allison is talking about and some of what she's done herself, is that babies are really active inquirers. They're really seized with figuring out the world. And their place in the world.
Although I don't see any evidence in her work that babies are busy putting together time and space, which aren't really real,
That's another thing. I'm just talking about the power of the mind to construe its world, and we have to do that actively. And babies, I think Allison is right, can teach us a lot about how that works. But, you know, this conversation continues, as always, on our blog, theblog.philosophytalk.org, where our motto is cogito ergo blago, I think, therefore I blog. And we also have a burgeoning Facebook page. If you're a fan of Facebook, sign up to be a fan of Philosophy Talk on Facebook.
And you can download podcasts of our program from our website as well. For the final word, we turn to the baby-faced wisdom of Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes, I can't really speak to the intelligence and creativity of babies, but I can tell you that I had an imaginary friend when I was 3 years old. Well, I don't remember the imaginary friend, but my mother says I had one, and why would my mother lie about something like that? My imaginary friend was named, somewhat unimaginatively, Person. Because I was 3, this came out Bursum. I did not have a toy gun, but I did have a rubber saw, which I considered to be some kind of ray gun. I would go out with Bursum into our backyard to kill skunks. This behavior was preceded, according to my mother, by me saying, "Come on, Bursum, let's go raise some snucks." Yes, it's hard to believe, but I was once, in fact, cute as a bug's ear. My mother, like mothers everywhere, was not shy about sharing accounts of my cute behavior with others when I was of an age at which I would have preferred to be considered brooding and or mysterious. For others to see me as the kind of guy who toddled around a backyard with a rubber saw and an imaginary friend shouting, "Ray, Ray, Ray," well, it just broke my heart. Where Bursum came from, I have no idea. My father was in Korea part of this time, so I may have been picking up the slack in the guy protecting home from invaders department, and realizing I was only 3, decided to conjure up some reinforcements in the form of Bursum for the job. But the skunks and ray gun, I don't know. One of my earliest memories occurred around the same time. Across the alley from us lived 2 wild brothers called the Blando Boys. One day they told me there was a bear living in a bush at the end of the alley. I expressed my doubts, so they brought me to the bush. While one of them distracted me, the other one hid behind the bush and made bear noises. That was all the proof I needed. I dashed home to tell my mother, who informed me that the bear was really just the Blando Boys having me on. Crushed, I had to admit the truth of what she was saying. The Blando Boys must have been all of 6 and 7 at the time, and therefore privy to all manner of sophisticated chicanery, especially adept at imitating the ways of wild bears. So, sadder but wiser, I grew older and Bursum free, staggering forward into a frightening world. So what did I learn from when I was 3 years old? Imaginary friends and ray guns don't help you in a pinch, that's one. If somebody tells you there's a bear in the bushes and you fall for it, you can always blame the Blando Boys, that's 2. And 3, imaginary friends are wasted on the young. Why don't we have them when we're middle-aged, when we really need them? I'm surrounded by snucks. Bursum, I'm waiting. I gotta go.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Manila Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2009.
Our executive producer is David Demarest. Special thanks to Kadar Lawrence.
Thanks also to Dan Brandon, April Dembowski, Merle Kessler, Kathy McClanahan, and Corey Goldman.
Our production coordinator is Devin Strolovich. Daniel Elstein and Ben Hirsch are our directors of research. Leo Weiss is our webmaster.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from the Stanford Humanities Center, various groups at Stanford University, and the Friends of Philosophy Talk.
And from the members of KALW, Local Public Radio, San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org.
I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.